Hello, and welcome to Lunchtime with Real Talk. You're listening to the voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. I'm Susan McCabe, your host for Real Talk. This is the show where I satisfy my curiosity about just about anything, and hopefully yours too, dear listener. Today, we're going to learn about a really interesting way to save the planet. This is a program promulgated by our local, probably most active activist, political activist on the island. He is Bill Moyer, president and chair of the Backbone Campaign. Welcome, Bill. Do I have your title right?
No, actually, that's cool. Universal like dictator or something like that would be okay. But I think that really I've only achieved executive director and co-founder of a project that's actually been a huge collaboration between many people and a bunch of islanders who co-founded the Backbone Campaign and folks who continue to support it. So I'm honored to be just the executive director.
Well, we are honored to have you here. How many years has the Backbone Campaign been active?
Well, I've got so many gray hairs since the beginning of it that it feels like maybe even longer, and I kind of sometimes inflate that. But no, it's been about 14 years exactly.
Wow.
Come up this December, yeah.
Wow. And that started during which presidential administration?
Way back at during the Bush administration, Bush 2. But the December of 2003 is when a group of us held a house party at Steve and Scylla's and Gordon's place and said, wouldn't it be cool if, wouldn't it be funny if, we developed a backbone platform and gave out backbone awards and delivered a 70-foot spandex backbone to the Democrats. And wouldn't that be funny? And then it turned into oh so much more over the years.
Certainly did. And that was, folks, for those who weren't around in 2003, the beginning of artists activists from Vashon Island. It was all about awarding Democrats who stood up to the Republicans at the time, correct?
Yeah, to the Bush administration in particular, post 9/11, this Patriot Act, the invasion of Iraq. All of these things that were, our very first banner before we were Backbone Campaign was Oil Men Leading Us Into Disaster. And that was in the end of 2002, I believe. And sure enough, here we are, oh, so many years later, with all of the blowback from all those terrible decisions. And we're suffering that. The incredible cost to our society and to the planet from the decisions that were made during that administration. I don't know that we'll ever dig ourselves out of that. Clearly, we've spent trillions and trillions of dollars recruiting enemies when we should have been spending trillions and trillions of dollars transforming our infrastructure and creating true security in our society and around the planet.
And that brings us to the topic for today, which is Solutionary Rail. You have co-authored a book. Could you give us the complete title and the name of your co-author and
you
how
betcha.
You chose that?
So the book is called Solutionary Rail, a people-powered campaign to electrify America's railroads and open corridors to a clean energy future. The co-writer, and there's a whole team that was involved in the creation of that book. The co-writer, lead writer, is Patrick Mazza, a great researcher and writer. And then the copy editor is Margot Boyer. The person who led the layout process was Kathy Fulton. And so Kathy and Margot are islanders. Rob Briggs, who used to be off island and now is on the island. He played a really significant role in the team, as did a number of people, rail electrification, transmission, and other experts around the country. And we worked with an artist in Bellevue named J. Craig Thorpe to do the art for the book.
Quite an undertaking. Tell us what is the premise of Solutionary Rail?
Yeah, and I might even preview that with why on earth is the Backbone Campaign doing this?
Well, yeah, good question.
I think that's a really logical question. And and one that occurs to folks who think of us as the puppet people, you know. But as we were doing a lot of work with creative tactics, everything from, you know, puppets to giant signs to et cetera, light projection and Kai activists, we became deeply involved in the local regional fight against fossil fuel transport and extraction, and the idea that the Puget Sound in some way was like its highest use was as a fossil fuel corridor to Asia. Huh. Well, that's obviously obscene to most of us who love this place. And yet in all of the work that we've done over the years, we've always known that our no, that which we're against, our no is only as powerful as our yes is compelling, that which we're fighting for.
Hmm.
So it was in that fight against coal trains and oil trains that I was in conversation with a labor, potential ally in labor, but who we were on the opposite side of the coal export issue. And this guy, Mike Elliott, and some of his cohorts, Jen Wallace, challenged us to consider to educate ourselves around the issues that are impacting railroad labor. And Mike at one point said to me, we did a, that he had been involved in a study of the Northern Transcon, rail corridor between Seattle and Chicago. And he said he'd been involved in a paper in 2008 about modernizing that corridor. And he said, why don't you see if your people, quote unquote, can green it, quote unquote. And so I thought, you know, with all the work that Backbone Campaign has done since we moved from being trying to get the Democrats to have a backbone, which was a operation that hasn't taken.
Never quite succeeded.
Yeah, it's not really, yet. But it's the problem with that perspective and that approach was that that's not actually how power and change happens. It's much more important that the people have the backbone and that they lift up the values and that we shift culture so that then the politicians move into a space where they have no choice but an existentially necessity to comply with this rising tide. So in the lessons from that, we know that expanding alliances, increasing the cohesion of those allies and deepening the resolve of people to be engaged in the change making in a way that resonates with their deepest values and aspirations, that we can't do that work if we don't have labor on board. We can't do that work if we don't have tribes on board. We can't do that work if we don't have folks in agriculture. Now, a lot of these folks are the people who we don't consider as our usual allies. These are unconventional allies. And what I love about rail, and the thing that got me so hooked, really, around the ideas around rail electrification and using the corridors for renewable energy transmission, was that the more and more we looked into this, the more I saw opportunities to create conversation with people we otherwise wouldn't be in conversation with, and a way to build a coalition that was extremely strategic and timely to have common cause for the common good.
There's not a whole lot of that going on these days.
Exactly. We've got a kind of populism now that is that appeals to the very worst in people.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that simultaneously we have the potential to have a kind of populism that appeals to the very best in people. I think populism is an appropriate reaction to the inherent corruption of our system and the sense that people's cares and aspirations aren't reflected in the policies and politics and aren't reflected in their actual experience of life getting better. Life isn't getting better
right.
for most people.
Right. So how will solutionary rail improve life?
Well, when you look at something like a railroad network on a map and you think, wow, that's a pretty important infrastructure. And then you realize it's controlled by private companies who are accountable to short-term profits of the markets and their shareholders, et cetera. You got to question, where is that an appropriate place for profit to be generated? You know, and it's what we've got. So then you've got to deal with, okay, well, that's a pretty important infrastructure, why isn't it working better for us? You know, so part of the book was to uncover what's been the history of rail. How's the ownership in the U.S. Impacting our ability for it to live up to its potential? And one of the things that we see is that only 3.5% of the value of freight moves on the railroads, and 70% of the value of freight moves on the trucks. And those trucks are tearing up the roads. They're spewing diesel into the communities where they connect with it. Ports or warehouses, they're causing this asthma. They're causing 4,000 traffic deaths and 100,000 injuries per year on the freeways. The workers of the truckers are not happy because of their working conditions.
And how does it affect climate change?
Exactly. You know, it's 27% of national greenhouse gas emissions come from our transportation sector. A large portion of that transportation sector is trucks. Trains are only a small portion of that, but then passenger vehicles are about 2/3. Now, I think we should actually back up a little bit and mm-hmm. say, well, how are the trains operating now?
Yes,
and why are they there? So the trains are haven't always been in the situation they're in now. They used to carry a lot more people and a lot more stuff. But when we built a publicly subsidized freeway infrastructure in the 40s, 50s, 60s, mm-hmm. right, that infrastructure caused an exodus of freight and people off of the trains and into cars and trucks. The trains could no longer sustain their role as a controlled monopoly or regulated monopoly. And then there was a bailout in the 70s when we created Amtrak. We relieved the railroad industry of having to serve passengers by creating Amtrak. That was a bailout. That wasn't a takeover. That was a bailout of the railroad industry because they weren't allowed to abandon service to people. They were obligated to provide service, and it was making their business unprofitable. So we bailed them out, took on Amtrak. But they increasingly became further and further dependent upon moving the stuff that wouldn't move by truck. So coal, and then more recently, oil, these heavy commodities. They increased their profits by making longer and longer trains that didn't travel on a schedule with fewer and fewer crew members. This creates chronic fatigue for the crew members who are on call 24/7. This creates public hazards and safety mm-hmm. problems for that. It also means that shippers who would normally or that historically would move things to one place to another on a train could no longer do that. I mean, trains are inherently more efficient, right? One, the surface area and the friction involved of that steel wheel on the track is like a tenth of the friction of that the rubber tire on the road.
Really?
Yeah. So there's an inherent efficiency of the train, aerodynamics, et cetera.
Despite the fact that they use fossil fuels to run.
But modern trains are, in the United States, in North America, are primarily diesel electric, like a lot of boats. That means that the diesel is running a generator that electrical power is actually running the trucks or the wheels in the train.
Mm-hmm.
So they're a diesel electric vehicle. So a diesel run by a diesel electric locomotive, that diesel electric engine also has inherent inefficiencies. Whenever you introduce an internal combustion engine to create energy, there's a loss of energy in the combustion process. And whether people say it's 25% of the energy is actually generated or 50%, it's still much less efficient than just taking power from an electric line above the train and going right into the engine. So there's a number of ways that trains are not as efficient as they could be. I would say that trains are very efficient, and there's ways that they can be yet more efficient. And the trick here is not so much it's important to decarbonize, to electrify the rail and to speed it up and modernize it and take out choke points, et cetera. But the reason that's so important for the climate is so that we can pull that freight off of the trucks and bring it back onto the tracks.
And reduce the use of trucks.
Right. And the other piece that's really important is that you could do that, but then you also, if you stick with the current system where things don't get on a train unless it's going 300, 500, even 750 miles minimum before it gets to its destination. That means that when it gets to the, we're concentrating the impacts of the both the trains and the trucks in these hubs like Kansas City or Chicago, or and where there's a rail yard and a warehouse system that's bringing all of these trucks into that system and spewing diesel in those communities. And then those trucks are having to travel hundreds and hundreds of miles back. Well, you can't electrify the trucks if they have to make many hundred mile journeys back. But if you stop more often, if you put things on the train and off the train more often on a regular basis, then shippers will go ahead and ship on the trains. If they're faster, they're more regular, they can they're predictable, then we can also electrify the trucking industry, because the trucking won't be about long haul trucking. It'll be about that last 50 miles, that last 100 miles, that last 200 miles, which makes everybody's life better, because that means that those are the kinds of trucks that you can actually electrify. You can run those on batteries, et cetera. Those trucks are being developed now. And that when those are going through communities, they're not spewing diesel. And those workers who drive those trucks actually get to go home at night. And
We're talking with Bill Moyer, Backbone Campaign Executive Director and co-author of the book Solutionary Rail, a people power campaign to electrify railroads. And I don't have that whole subtitle correct. I'm Susan McCabe, your host. It's Real Talk, and we can do this. We can do all our community information programming thanks to Windermere Vashon Realty, who sponsors all our community information programming and our 1650 AM emergency alert service. Bill Moyer, in your book, you talk about solutionary rail boosting the economies or boosting rural America and diversifying agriculture. How would it do that?
That's related exactly to what we were just talking about, in that if the trains once again serve those communities where currently the train, the station is boarded up, but if it restores service to those places, and that service is fast enough and regular enough, and that farmers can get commodities or perishables to market, or local producers of and manufacturers can get manufactured goods to market, then we start to bolster rural economies and make those rural places more livable. The other thing that's really significant about the solutionary rail proposal is that we're proposing that those private railroad rights of way be utilized for the transmission of renewable energy. So we all know that the sun isn't always shining in one place or another,
especially here.
Yeah. And the wind isn't always blowing, but sometimes it does.
Yes.
Yeah. The problem with renewable energy is the variability. Now, one of the fascinating things that I learned through this process is that 75% of the U.S. landmass is served by rural electrical cooperatives.
Wow.
I know. It's because it was profitable for folks to put in electric service in cities. But when there's a lot of space between people, that wasn't profitable. So that was part of, you know, New Deal time in 1935, that circa 1935, the rural electrical cooperatives were created and supported so that they could provide electrification to rural America. Well, that doesn't mean, I used to think that, wow, those people must be really excited about distributed renewable energy, putting windmills and solar farms on farmers' land and spreading that out. But in truth, they're not. That network of rural power cooperatives and generation cooperatives and transmission cooperatives is also very indebted to a infrastructure of fossil fuel generation, and they want to pay off that debt before cheap other power comes online. So one of the things that Solutionary Rail offers is an opportunity to, one, require that the trains run on renewable energy all along the route, which gives those rural electrical cooperatives a new market or load.
Oh.
It also gives them a way. We think that those corridors should be for high voltage transmission as well, so that gives rural places a way to export their disproportionate access to wind and solar energy to population centers. And in their places like Yakima and the Yakima Nation, they have a utility called Yakima Power. And Yakima Power has an emphasis and a value system that supports the development of renewable energy development. But what they've run up against is that unless they can export, have a place for the surplus electrons to go at peak production, they can't get the financing or the regulatory approval to put in that production. So if a BNSF railroad, Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad, is going through their community and is obligated to run on renewable energy, and there's a system into which they can put their surplus energy, and that they can also potentially draw from power from when their windmills aren't turning, that all of a sudden creates an opportunity for energy sovereignty on tribes and in communities. It creates an opportunity for exporting energy. So that's just yet another way that Solutionary Rail serves rural communities and tribal communities.
Clearly, you and your team have done an incredible amount of research, and you understand how your proposal is going to fan out in so many different ways. What sort of infrastructure has to be? First of all, yeah. I think you're telling me that our current rail system is sufficient to cover the entire country.
That's right.
Or Solutionary Rail. So what has to be done to that rail infrastructure, and what is that going to cost? That's just the basic change, right?
That's right. And first of all, let's start off by saying what we shouldn't do. we shouldn't get so excited about ultra high speed rail from Vancouver, BC to Seattle, Washington, that's got to cut new corridor at $125 million to $1 billion per mile. That has already been studied. Microsoft and Jay Inslee might be really excited about that, but that's a boondoggle. That's a distraction. We should not be waiting for Elon Musk to put in a Hyperloop or whatever that the vacuum tube thing is. We don't need to do that. This is not a Jetson era proposal. This is about using technology and infrastructure that has been there for the last 100 years. You know, in 1928, Washington State had 750 miles of electrified rail.
Really?
In 1915, GE created the first locomotive in the U.S. that could do regenerative braking, meaning when it's going down the mountain pass, it's putting energy back into the wires that are helping the train on the other side get up the mountain pass. We have been doing this in Washington State and in the U.S. for a long time, and we were actually the model for other countries.
So what happened?
Well, there was in the consolidation of railroads and in some poor management and some bankruptcies, the Milwaukee Road, and other railroads went under as diesel powered locomotives became dominant in at a certain time period. So, but getting back to your question about what needs to happen,
yeah,
because we have a very fragmented ownership structure of our railroads, and they're privately owned, and the return on investment of major infrastructure improvement isn't fast enough for the quote-unquote, you know, markets or shareholders, we need to overcome that challenge. And we're not proposing to nationalize the railroads. Some people would reasonably make that demand, but that's not what we're demanding. What we're demanding is that our public officials and that they partner with the railroad industry to negotiate access to the overhead space and to do improvements on existing rail right-of-way with grade separation, electrification, transmission in order to speed up and create the improvements that will draw the freight off of the trucks and back onto the tracks.
So with that electrification of the rails, are the trains themselves then easily retrofitted to operate on electricity alone?
Well, some people can say that they're easily retrofitted. There's certainly there's long-term savings in using electric locomotives over diesel electric locomotives because, again, with diesel electric, with an internal combustion engine, there's just more that goes wrong. Mm-hmm. But there would be some need for conversion to electric locomotives. There's lots of job opportunities in the creation of those locomotives, in the installation of this infrastructure. And what we've been proposing is a unique kind of entity that would be, I want to make a point. One of the obstacles to the private railroads doing this infrastructure improvement is that they, because they're a private landowner, they would pay property taxes on the improvements on that corridor. So when they put in all that extra infrastructure, the value of that infrastructure goes up and they pay taxes on that. Now, they might come to us someday because there's an inevitability about electrification. Everybody else in the world is doing it. And they might say, you need to bail us out again, just like you did in the 70s and you need to pay for that and you need to exempt us from that. But that's not the direction we should go because those little communities, they rely on that tax base. What we are proposing instead is that we create a corridor by corridor steel interstate development authorities that leverage the tax exempt status of states and tribes to own and operate, finance, build and operate the improvements on the corridor. And that the tax exempt status then allows those communities to still collect on the taxes without the railroads having to, companies having to have an additional burden. And it allows us to create public benefit mandates around that the trains need to be run on electricity, that the service needs to be returned to communities, that the trains need to have a minimum crew sizes, and that right-of-way justice issues that remain important to tribes, that those get resolved, and that local communities aren't impacted, and ports aren't impacted by the diesel the diesel health impacts of the trucking industry.
Bill Moyer of Backbone Campaign and Solutionary Rail, we have about a minute left. In that minute, I would like you to tell us who your partners are in moving this forward and how our listeners can become involved and or help.
So real quickly then, the Washington State Labor Council passed a resolution to the governor. The Washington State Sierra Club has passed a resolution to the governor. We're working with recruiting folks from the League of Women Voters and other organizations to join in passing resolutions to the governor. And we've got local political organizations, et cetera, doing that. We have a regular call that folks can participate in. They go to solutionaryrail.org and look for upcoming events or send an email to bill@solutionaryrail.org and I will keep you on or sign up for notifications. We'd ask folks to get the book, share it with your friends. It's an inexpensive, it's easy read. It's got lots of pictures, which is perfect for a person like me. And it's a great gift. And we think that what we're doing is spreading through coalitions around the country this idea of rail electrification and the solutionary rail approach that more and more organizations are getting on board with.
Thank you. Thank you, Bill Moyer, for joining us today here on Real Talk and for all that you're doing for climate change and have done for the last 14 years. I have always been impressed and humbled by the amount of energy you put into all this stuff.
Ah, thank you so much, Susan. Thank you for Voice of Vashon. It's just can't be emphasized enough what an important service you are to this community and to the world.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us, folks. We're going to be here at lunchtime every Tuesday with one interesting topic or another. This is Real Talk on KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vashon.